Welcome back to another episode of In My Opinion on the Sweat Elite podcast. Today I have a guest actually who's going to be joining me for the entire episode, Casper Peterson. Many would be familiar with Casper as he is the head coach of triathlon at Sweat Elite Coaching Academy. And Casper's just come from the T100 in Singapore. So we've got plenty of interesting behind the scenes information coming from there and a few different topics that we'll both speak to about triathlon and running. But Casper, how are you doing post-Singapore?
Yeah, thank you, man. And thank you for having me on the pod once again. It's always a pleasure to be here and really interesting to chat about everything in running and especially the triathlon world. So yeah, as you mentioned, just got home from Singapore this Monday, where the second round of the new World Triathlon Series in middle long distance triathlon was held in Singapore. I was there with Magnus Ditlev as I'm working in the team around him. And then I had some hope for also having Ruth Essel, who is a pro triathlete as well in the women's field. She was like the first reserve. So also for people who are not familiar with the T100 series, it's like a series for the 20 best male athletes, the 20 best female athletes who will be competing over 8 races over the entire year. And in the end, they will be crowned like a world champion in middle long distance triathlon. And the setup around it is that they really want to do it a little bit like the Formula One of triathlon. So trying to race around Europe, Asia, the States, etc., and really make more events where the best of the best is on the start line together. And at every race, there will always be like a reserve athlete or so who can be pulled in if any athlete isn't starting. But I would say, fortunately, all women were healthy and fit to race. So unfortunately, Ruth didn't got the spot. But yeah, my unluck as a coach didn't end there, as Magnus unfortunately crashed on his bike. And I think it was only the second day we were in Singapore, actually. And it was actually like not a really dramatic crash or anything. He was just out riding for the first time. Just an easy ride, 2 hours. And then on the back end of that 2 hour ride, he was going on the last part before he just actually came to our hotel, just cruising around. There was a speed bump and he was sitting out as his base bar, like just pushing 190, 200 watts, which is quite easy. And then like, because also what everyone was talking about was the heat and humidity in Singapore. And he was so sweaty after that 2 hour ride and he was sitting out of his base bar. And he doesn't really have any tape on his base bar. So he actually just slipped over it, going over the speed bump. And then, yeah, fell really hard down on his right side. And I think he took off with his left wrist, which unfortunately showed a fracture when we went to the hospital immediately after and got an MRI. And obviously that was the end of our week in Singapore. We tried to, for the first 2 or 3 days, to keep our hopes high. So the following day, Magnus was actually having treatment for just over 3 hours, I think, where they really tried to loosen up his body after the crash, looking at his wrist and trying to find out different ways that he could maybe be able to swim if we strapped it on correctly and so on, with like the shin he had. So yeah, but yeah, he tried to bike as well indoor, but he couldn't really put pressure on it. And then obviously, I mean, as I said in the beginning, when you're putting the 20 best male athlete on the start line in a race like Singapore, which is so hot and humid, you don't want to be just 1% off. And in his case, he was more than 1% off. So, I mean, also coming in as the leader of the series, as he won the first race, there is obviously a lot of pressure on him as well. But I mean, in the end, we actually turned it around to something positive and we actually decided to stay there the whole week in Singapore, watching the women's race and the men's race as well, and helped out like PTO with certain commitments. Magnus was also commentating and being in the pre and post race show, etc. So it actually ended up, even though it was very frustrating, of course, and especially for Magnus, but eventually it ended up being a good week in Singapore, being together with friends and athletes of our great sport of triathlon. So in that way, it was still a good week, I would say.
Yeah, the commentators were shouting you out a couple of times, and every time they would, I would put it in the group chat, in the T100 chat, "Hey Casper, I don't know if anyone noticed, but they did actually say your name. I think it was at least twice. But yeah, obviously pretty rough news about Magnus. I didn't know the specifics about the crash, so that was interesting to hear. I knew that he had the incident in the days leading in, but I didn't realize it played out like that, although I kind of came to the assumption that it might be something like that. I do love the way, though, that he had hope after finding out he had a fractured wrist that he might still race.
Yeah, I mean, and the funny thing is actually that we had, by the way, if he for any reason is listening, we had like a really, really nice and friendly doctor who was a really like great guy who helped us out immediately after the crash, got us into a hospital where we could get the scan even after it was closed, actually. But he managed somehow to keep it open for us. And they were actually quite positive and tried to come up with different solution on how he would be able to swim and how he would be able to hold his bike, etc. And then after that, we sent the scans directly home to our team in Denmark and the doctors we have attached there. And I would say they were not as positive as our doctors in Singapore. But I think they just wanted him to race and also keep faith in him. And I think also when like these things happen, obviously when you have traveled always almost halfway around the world to race the T100 series, which is a big goal of his season, then I mean you want to try at least to see what you can do. But also one thing we actually discussed afterwards was that whenever things like this happen, we should just say to ourselves that, like, we are not racing. I mean, we want to be 100% fit and ready to race. I mean, it's just not sustainable or good enough to be 5% off, especially not in conditions like this. So I think that's also one positive thing we can take with us moving forward is that if things like this happen, obviously now we had commitments with T100 and PTO, etc., but if it was like a normal race, let's say Kona, for instance, example, if this happens 2 weeks prior, we are in Kona, we just travel home. Like there's no need to try and fix stuff and not be 100% when we're racing. I mean, Magnus is also a caliber of an athlete and an athlete with that mindset that everything has to be 110%. So obviously if he is not ready to race, like just 2 or 3 or 4% off, then he shouldn't toe the line. I mean, we are there to win. The whole team around him is built to win. So, I mean, yeah, being off is just not an option anymore. We need to be there.
I'm going to play devil's advocate with you in a minute, though, just for a minute. I think that idea about just deciding, no, we're not going to race, makes sense in 90% of cases. And especially when it's a physical injury, right? Because, you know, if you're going into the start worrying about that injury, it's never good. But I think the challenge comes when you have an immune system deficiency. So if you have COVID or you're sick and you're trying to see if you're going to recover in time for race day, I think that's when it's a little bit more difficult. But I know that you're referring more to a fact of like a physical problem, and I couldn't agree more with that. I think if you're going into the race worried about nursing an injury, it very rarely works out. I think you can point to a couple of cases where it might work out with people that have Achilles tendinopathy or something like that. But yeah, that's super interesting. I'm curious to learn, once Magnus had, you know, the dust had settled and you guys had decided he wasn't racing, was there any discussion amongst you guys around who might come in the top three? Or maybe you could just talk about your predictions after Magnus had realized that he was no longer racing. Because, you know, my favorite was Magnus to win, especially after the way he dominated Miami. But after that, I was left not really being very sure who would win. So who were you thinking was going to be in the podium? And any more behind the scenes stories about Singapore would be really good to hear from, because I feel like there's always little things going on in the background that people would find interesting.
Yeah, I mean, if we can start with the predictions, we were actually sitting in like the athletes area 1 hour before the start. We were sitting with Jack Kelly, who was the commentator and is also the host of the Triathlon Hour, exactly. And we were like coming up with the prediction. I think Jack will be happy when I'm saying this, because he was actually saying that his favorite was Yuri Kulin, who eventually ended up winning the race. And Magnus said Sam. And I actually went with Alistair. That's also due to the fact that Ruth, who I'm coaching, his boyfriend is Alistair, and I've got some details about his training and his preparation. I knew for a fact that he was really, really fit and ready to deliver a good performance. And just for if people haven't watched the race, Alistair was actually also in the mix of things. But unfortunately, in T2, when he was doing the dismount, he landed in a weird way on his ankle and kind of twisted it. And he tried to run on it for two laps, but eventually, like, he couldn't really put any pressure on it. And I think once the adrenaline was a little bit more out of the system, he could really feel the pain. But yeah, I think Magnus was also really close with predicting Sam Long, who I think also, I think we have to mention him here, what Sam is doing at the moment. Like, also in Miami, he was obviously the runner-up to Magnus. And I think, honestly, it's really amazing that, like, having two such consistent performances with being second in Miami, second in Singapore. But I think what is even more impressive is the fact that in Miami, he was 3.5 minutes down out of the water. In Singapore, I think, like, already after 100 meters, he was completely alone on the swim. I think all the other athletes, at least until the end of the first lap, like, one lap was 1,000 meters, they were all together. Sam was on his own already from the get-go, and he came out 4 minutes behind after the swim, which is, I mean, in this level of racing, honestly, your race at that point should be ended. I mean, I also talked about this with Magnus, like, I would just take my things from T1 and go back to the hotel. But I think what is so amazing with Sam is that also even on the bike, I remember a clip where they recorded where I think that was only like 2 or 3K into the bikes. Like, he was almost just yelling, yo, 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 smiling. And like, his whole attitude and so on is so positive. And I know for a fact also, like, talking with Sam pre and post the race, that, I mean, obviously, even though that he looks really positive, it is actually quite difficult for him mentally to really keep focused and believe in himself. I mean, obviously, he has to do this, but it really takes a huge mental capacity to keep believing that he eventually will be a part of the race. I mean, imagine starting a marathon where you are 4 minutes down to Kipchoge or so, and still, okay, have in mind, okay, I will be able to get into the race. I mean, that's almost impossible to even think about. And the fact that then Sam could finish second here in Singapore, also actually serving a 30-second penalty as well, just makes it even more impressive. But yeah, I mean, he's really a talking point at the moment. And I mean, whenever he will get his swim dialed in, maybe just being 3 minutes behind on the swim, 2.5 minutes, I think he will even be even more dangerous than he is now. So yeah, it is quite impressive. I mean, obviously, we should have in mind that it is swim, bike, run. So, I mean, you have to be able to swim. But if you take the swim out, for instance, in Miami, only look at the bike run performance, I think he would have won Miami with 2 minutes or 1.5 minutes down to Magnus, who did a very, very strong bike and run as well. So that showcases how, I mean, his motto is that he has the strongest legs in triathlon. And I think he has really made that a testament by now.
I was about to pull that joke into the picture and say the strongest legs in triathlon are forgetting about one of the legs in triathlon. He might need to get stronger arms as well. But yeah, he's very entertaining to follow. I'm a big fan of Sam just because he's very funny to just listen to and to observe. But yeah, to be that far behind on the swim and then get the 30-second penalty and to then still come second and beat a pretty hard field is funny. I'm really surprised Jack picked Yuri before the race. That's surprising. Tell me more about that. I like Jack Kelly's podcast, by the way. I listen to a lot of those episodes. Yeah.
Yeah, he's a really funny character. We were one of the evenings we were out eating dinner with Jack, his girlfriend, and Frederick Funk and his girlfriend as well. And I mean, Jack, he has some crazy ass stories. And I don't know if every story he tells is truth. I think he's really good at
spicing them.
I don't know if this is, I mean, if people is under 18 and is hearing this podcast, I don't think it'll be friendly to
No, everyone's ever 18. Everyone's ever 18.
Yeah, I think we that must be like a premium episode which we have to record, which people can buy into or something like that. And no, but yeah, I would say obviously Dewey, he came in as I think he was fourth in Miami actually. And the funny thing is that, as I mentioned early on, it's like 20 contracted athletes who is a part of the series, and then PTO or T100 decides to take in wildcards now and then for the races, or substitutes if an athlete is injured, if one of the contracted athletes is injured, and so on. And Yui was called in as a wild card for the race in Miami and obviously did very well. So he was also called in now to Singapore, and obviously now won and is actually the leader of the series, even though he's not a contracted athlete, which in itself is quite interesting to think of. But yeah, I mean, I think Yui, it is a bit of a surprise to me, but it's also, I mean, when you also look at his progress in the sport, I think he has an ITU background. So he is a very well, like he's a good swimmer. His run is really like his force. And by the end of last year, he was actually delivering some really good results. I think he actually beat Alistair Brownlee in a race as well, where they ran out together, and he eventually ended up running faster than Alistair and took the win. I think it was one of the challenge half distance races. So yeah, I mean, he has some good results in this bank, but this was obviously his really like breakthrough performance. But I mean, I think, and this is not to take anything away from Yui's performance at all. So it shouldn't be think of in a wrong way, but I think in the races where Magnus is in, like the dynamic is always completely different. I mean, and it was also a talking point now when Magnus wasn't on the start line in Singapore, because I think with Magnus, like obviously he's so strong on the bike, and I think eventually he just, I don't know if it's because people fear him or like have to act on the way that Magnus is approaching the race, etc. But I just, from several races now, I can see that whenever Magnus isn't there, it always plays out completely different, or, yeah, don't get me wrong, but like weird things happen where now Yui broke away on the bike, where strong guys like Alistair, Peter Himrik, yeah, Laidlaw obviously didn't have his day, Peter Himrik, etc., wasn't really able to bridge up and so on. And I think these things just happen when Magnus is not in the race, and also a guy like Mathis Machere, who decided also not to race in Singapore, but he finished third in Miami, is a really strong biker as well. And I think sometimes when you take these really, really strong individuals, especially on the bike where the dynamics is so important, I think when you take two such big calibers out of the race, then the dynamics is just completely different, and that opens up the race for more people. And again, just a testament is not to take anything away from Yui, because I mean, if Magnus was in the race, it would still have been really difficult to beat Yui. And you obviously have to be on the start line to even be able to win a race. So yeah, but I think he did deliver a really, really strong performance. And obviously he's one too that, yeah, we in team Magnus Ditlev is really focusing on for the next races.
No, I've heard different opinions before about when Magnus is in the race, and it was the same with Jan, right? Like when they're in the race, these big names that are the ones that are sort of more feared, the dynamics completely do change, which is hard to describe and hard to even really see. But from your standpoint, when you observe these races and watch Magnus race and then watch races without Magnus, you can really sort of see a difference. It's not an uncommon opinion of yours, I don't think, to think that when the favorite and someone that's so strong in the bike flag is not there, the race then changes quite a lot. So yeah, I think it's interesting. But I want to ask you something we actually spoke a little bit about off air, and it's about heat training. And I think this is where the In My Opinion episode get interesting, in that we sort of touch on particular topics, and we'll get more to more specific coaching questions soon. And I've got a couple of good ones for you, given that you're now coaching quite a few people in the triathlon space in Coaching Academy. But we spoke a little bit about heat training and Magnus's experience with heat training leading into Singapore. Let's talk a little bit more about that, because you mentioned a few interesting things that you've recently learned about sauna training with Ruth and so on. So this is something that you asked me, right? Like the other day you said, have you done any heat training before your marathons to prep for the cramping? And I sort of say, well, not really, because my focus isn't really myself. I wouldn't necessarily go on a training camp just for me. I'd only ever go if there's work involved, if there's filming there as well. So I've never really prioritized the heat training camp. But you've had some experience here, so it'd be good to talk more about this if you can, because we've got a lot of warm races coming up in the next few months for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I think heat training is one thing that has started to be more and more attractive for athletes, and especially pro athletes. And I think with heat training, there is quite some significant benefits. Not only, like, I think when people are thinking heat training, they are more just thinking, okay, then I will obviously be better to perform in the heat and so on, and get used to being able to keep a high intensity in hotter conditions, more humid conditions, etc. But there's also the whole physical benefit from it in terms of like hemoglobin levels that are increasing, the blood plasma, more red blood cells, etc., which eventually is beneficial and can be used also like in the same way as altitude, which I think, and this is where I think heat training is becoming really interesting, because like the fact that you have with altitude training, it can be quite difficult in terms of that you have to travel. Sometimes when you're living up in really high altitude, weather as well isn't as good as you might want it to be, snow, etc., all these kind of things. You maybe don't have all the facilities you need. Obviously, when you have like a place as Sierra Nevada, where you have the track up there, you have the 50-meter pool and so on, that's obviously really nice. But I think that's not everyone has the access or the possibility to go to Sierra Nevada, for instance. But now the fact with heat training that you can get some of the same benefits by doing it even like in your home with biking with a lot of clothes on. If you have a sauna close by, you can go to the sauna. So it eventually makes it way more easy. But that can also, I mean, for normal runners out there listening, one of the things is that now that it gets more accessible, it can also be a little bit dangerous in terms of the fact that if people are not aware of that extra stress, which is given to your training, eventually then it can end up being like have a negative influence on the training rather than a positive one. And I think that's where it becomes really interesting as well, because as you mentioned, Matt, we were talking about this off air. And I think, for instance, with Ruth, we have slowly started to implement heat training in some periods of a season. It's not something we do the whole year, because as mentioned, the stress is quite high. And also when you are in heavy training, you don't want to have too much of a stress. So this is only a thing we do in certain periods, because compared to a guy like Magnus, where we have been doing heat training now for almost over 2.5 years before he went into his first Ironman in Texas, which is really hot and humid. So obviously Magnus is way more used to it. And we also have like an individual protocol for him, which we use. So the protocol we use for Magnus isn't the same one we use with Ruth. So, I mean, that's also where there is, it's really easy accessible, but there's also way more things to it than just go into the sauna for 30 minutes, maybe a couple of times during the week. Like it's way more complicated than that.
So you have to really be understanding and aware that like when you do too much in the sauna, you have to know when the point of diminishing returns is, right? When it's actually becoming affecting your training. And interestingly enough, I don't know if you're familiar with Ed Goddard from Australia. He's a marathon runner. I believe his best is 2:10 now or 2:11. London Marathon a couple of years ago, he actually learned this lesson the hard way, and he did sauna too much in the 2 weeks leading in. And he realized like the day before that he just was feeling really flat and really tired from the amount of heat training. And he had a pretty bad race. And he pretty much pointed to the fact that he thinks he did too much of it. So, but he was going every day for like 30 minutes. So I think that's probably where he went wrong.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, I can't go too much into details with the protocol that we are using with Magnus and Ruth, but I can say that there is also due to the fact that Magnus is way more used to it, that like when we are doing a heat block with him, he's doing heat every day in certain different ways of heat exposure. Where Ruth at this point, when we have just finished a heat block with her, where we did like more 2 weeks, kind of more building into it, and then two more aggressive weeks. But in the beginning of that heat block, we were only having a heat exposure. I think we tried to get it in 4 days a week in like the beginning of it. And then when we went into the more specific and aggressive heat part of the protocol, that was also where, when she was in first Malaysia and then Singapore, because we, that was also the good thing that obviously, as I mentioned in the beginning, she was the first reserve for Singapore. So it was a good opportunity for us to test the heat protocol before she went, potentially could race Singapore. So when she was out there, she tried to get heat exposure every day. That was also, that was why it was a way more aggressive part of the heat protocol. But that just to say that you can't really just copycat what Magnus is doing or what Ruth is doing, because as an athlete, you might even need more or less. And it also depends on how much stress you have in terms of training, maybe work, etc. So there's so many things you have to circle around in order to make it perfect.
I think this boils back to the same point that some things in training and racing are about trial and error and understanding, learning what works for you. But you know, knowing the basics, which you've shared here, is really helpful. So appreciate that. So Casper, we've had quite a few people join you at the Coaching Academy since you started.
Yeah, it's great.
One question we regularly have is, am I good enough for Casper? Mm-hmm. Am I professional enough? And we keep telling people, like, you know, we take on professional athletes, you coach professional athletes, but you also coach amateur athletes. And I think it would be a good time to talk about this, that the fact that there is differences in how you approach the training, right? But it'd be good to hear from you. We've spoken about this, obviously, but, you know, if people are wondering, how does really the difference between coaching a real pro athlete that's in the T100 or close to the T100 differ as opposed to someone that might be working 40 hours a week and might have only 10, 12, 14 hours maximum to train? We could talk a bit about that. I think people would find this interesting.
Yeah. Sure,
because you have a big spectrum of athletes.
I would say the funny thing is that, especially that's where I'm sometimes really amazed with also the athletes we have at Sweat Elite Academy, but obviously also other age group athletes, is that some of the age group athletes is actually training close to the same amount of hours which professional athletes is training. And for some it works, for some it can also be too much. Actually, I took in an age group athlete here at the Sweat Elite Coaching Academy who sometimes were training over 30 hours a week. And I mean, it's pretty amazing considering that he also have a full-time job. Obviously, like he has a full-time job where he's quite flexible and he can also work in weekends and so on. But I also told him that, I mean, it really, hats off that you can fit it in. And in the end, it's because you really want it and you are so dedicated. But I think that sometimes more is not always more. More is also sometimes less, and less is sometimes more. And in his case, less is more. So we eventually took down his hours a bit. But I think, like, if we take him as an example compared to a guy like Magnus, I mean, they were potentially actually training the same amount of hours plus 30 hours a week. And I mean, obviously, as you know it as a well, Matt, that even though you're training the same amount of hours, obviously the session differs compared to individual aspects and needs and so on. But I think one of the major things isn't necessarily the training, but it's more the things around training, where like a professional athlete has more time able to recover, make sure that they get in good nutrition, take that like 30 minute nap during midday prior to sessions. They can spread out the sessions a bit more, so they maybe don't have to do swim, bike, run like in the first half of the day, but they can actually spread it out. So maybe a morning swim with a jog afterwards, then they have a second breakfast, can take a like long recovery, get lunch, then they can bike in the afternoon. Maybe an age group athlete doesn't have that possibility. So even though that they actually train the same amount of hours during the day, but the fact that the professional has the ability to spread it out just makes it completely different. Like it's completely different in terms of what you can get out of the session, how much more fresh you are into it. But the funny thing is also that I think even as a professional athlete, even though you have the time and the availability to have be more focused on your recovery, getting the right nutrition in and so on. I have also experienced from my work with talent development here in Denmark and also taking in a few like newbie pro athletes that even though they have the availability to do it, it's also a learning process where even professional athletes like sometimes have to learn that, okay, we really need to be focused on this because sometimes they can also just be all locked in on training and then sometimes forgetting that you're an athlete 24/7. It's not only when you're training. And obviously everyone, whether you're an age group athlete, you're a professional athlete, you can be, there can just come things up where, okay, I have to take care of this. And that's, I mean, that's the name of the game. That's just life. I mean, it happens. But I mean, professional athletes just also have to have in mind that they are on duty 24/7, especially as a professional triathlete. You need to get in like a protein shake or recovery meal 10 to 15 minutes after the session. You need to get in your massage, etc. All these kind of things. Where as an age group athlete, you just maybe don't have that possibility. And sometimes when you're having kids at home, you can maybe just not get pasta for dinner or so on. You also need to cook special dishes for them and all these kind of things which you have to juggle and eventually will make you feel a little bit more tired going into sessions, even though that you might be training the same hours as a professional.
Yeah, I do wonder, like you mentioned people working full time, but then training 30 hours a week. I mean, I spoke to Rudy von Berg yesterday and he said he trains about 26, 28 hours a week. So to think that a professional, to think of a person working full time and training 30 hours a week. I mean, you've told me about this, right? But there must be, this is probably a very generalized question, but there must probably be a point where if you can observe in the athletes or the person's life that they've got a lot going on, it's quite stressful. There's probably a point of, like you're saying, like less is actually more, because oftentimes if you have a very busy life, very stressful job, maybe that disrupts the sleep. Training hard can often be a hindrance. Like you're not getting anything out of the training if your stress is too high and you're too busy, basically. So there's probably some cases where you have to tell people, hey, you know, let's not worry about the amount of time that you're training. Let's actually just try and focus in on the specifics of moving the needle forward with the relevant zones of training that you want to move forward with. And it must be an interesting task for you to, because in running, it's like everyone kind of knows that 14, 15 hours a week of training, much more than that, doesn't really make sense unless you're Kelvin Kiptum. He somehow managed to train more than that. But most people, if you train more than that, you're just going to overtrain, right? Whereas in triathlon, that's not the case because you're dealing with three different disciplines. They all need somewhere between 5 and 10 hours a week of training. But yeah, you must be telling people often to like, hey, let's actually do a bit less and that will actually be a better outcome for your performance. Would you say like that's something that you have to sometimes tell people or?
Yeah, and I'm actually thinking of a pretty good example is that one athlete at the Sweat Elite Coaching Academy, he actually had the option to take 2 weeks off from work. So he had like more space to train at, like actually just doing a home training camp for 2 weeks. And he's actually training quite a lot of hours. And obviously, I think when I scheduled his 2 week training camp, he was maybe looking forward to even more training. But the funny thing was that I think maybe he got 1 hour more of training for like during each week. And I remember like he was texting me like, is this it? And I was like, yeah, this is it, because you are already training quite a lot of hours. And obviously I had to add on that the main purpose of this training camp now is not that you should be training more because your volume is actually quite high, but now you have the opportunity to live like a pro, which means, as we said before, be aware of getting in like a recovery meal directly after training. Try to spread out your sessions so you can do your swim in the morning. You can maybe do a post-swim run. Then you can have a long break, refuel, get mentally ready for a harder session in the evening. Could maybe be a double run or it could be a interval session on the bike, etc. Make sure that you can now actually maybe, not that you can sleep 10 hours during the night, but you can eventually be in your bed for 10 hours, maybe sleep 9 instead of only 7 hours. So, I mean, all these kind of things just to make sure that whenever he goes into the session, he can actually get more out of a certain session. And eventually that will also make him better. And I mean, that's also where I think too many athletes out there who also is dealing with full-time job, etc. Sometimes people are just looking, especially in triathlon. I don't think it's really the same in running, and correct me here if I'm wrong, Matt, but I think especially in triathlon where you can train so many hours, people are really just focused on the hours rather than also like, okay, what are you getting out of those hours?
What are you actually doing in those hours?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, because if you are slugging around and you're tired and you can't really swim with a proper technique, your movement pattern is bad and so on, it's like, okay, yeah, you're burning calories, but I mean, that's not what triathlon is about. So it's about getting fast from A to B, bike, swim, and run. So that was actually a really good example and a good question, which I think maybe it will be a good idea for listeners out there to reflect on and say, okay, whenever I go to a training camp, if I'm already training a good amount of hours, okay, should I actually maybe just stick to this? And then just focusing more on recovery, getting good nutrition, sleep even more. And then I think a lot of people will be surprised of how much more they can eventually get out of their sessions. So yeah.
That reminds me, there's a few different parallels you could draw to this. My last full-time job, which actually happened to be in Singapore, most of my staff members were working 50 hours a week, but I wasn't exactly sure what they were doing in those 50 hours of the week. I noticed it wasn't that much. So, but also the analogy can be drawn to joining a gym and going 3 days a week, but not doing that much in the gym, just stretching. But no, good to see that you've got them on track and making sure they're getting the most out of the hours. I couldn't agree more. I mean, you know, I tell this story all the time and some people might be rolling their eyes because I've heard it a lot of times, but and there's so many nuances to this. I'm very aware, a lot of nuances, but I ran my best marathon off very low mileage because I focused on getting the most out of every workout I could possibly get. And there is definitely a big focus on the endurance sports of doing more. And oftentimes it's just, it can be a bit of a dangerous headspace to get into because then you end up doing so much, tiring yourself out on such a level that, you know, you're not really ready for, and you might not be hitting the right zones and the right intensities at the right times. And I think that's sort of the beauty of having a good coach. And yeah, once again, thanks to you for joining us and helping people out in the triathlon space, because we've already had plenty of good feedback as well. So, but the next thing I wanted to ask you about was testing. You've done quite a bit of testing with Ruth. We've seen some videos. You've sent me some pictures on WhatsApp. What do you think about testing? And that's a broad word, right? We could use lactate, VO2, heart rate, all these things. You can relate this to Magnus. You can relate it to Ruth. You can relate it to any athlete that you coach. But do you think there's a lot of value in testing? And then why do you think that? And what sort of information are you getting from Ruth's testing to enable you to coach in a better way?
Oh, I think that it's really interesting, Christian, because testing can be really beneficial and testing can be... like it doesn't really matter if you don't understand your testing. And I think that's actually the most important thing, is because, I mean, everyone can do lactate testing if they have a lactate meter and so on. But if you don't really understand the data you get out of it, you can actually destroy your training or the scheduling of your training if you're then basing your training programs off some data that you don't really understand yourself. And then eventually it will end up being a disaster rather than having a positive benefit. And I think also that's, for instance, if we take Ruth as an example, we obviously been in the lab. We did this early on in the season. And that was also because I took in Ruth the 1st of January this year. And obviously I could look through Ruth's training peaks and her old training and also getting her feedback on what she felt that has been positive in her training, what has been negative, what has she responded well on, what is her limits and so on. And then combining that with a test in the lab obviously just gives us even more data. But I'm also aware that with all these data, which you can get in a lab, like I don't have a sports science degree, which eventually I don't think it's a negative thing. But I'm just making sure that with the pro athletes I'm working with, when we're getting so much data, which is also on a very high level, that I have persons around and people around that can analyze and really understand these data and explain it to me, explain it to Ruth, explain it to other important people of the team, so we eventually can make a plan out of it. So obviously I'm in the lab, I'm also helping with doing the testing and so on. But in the end with Ruth, we have a sports scientist attached who is called Dan. He's Dan Snape, such a good guy from the Leeds University. He also helps me and Ruth with the heat protocol we are doing with her, which obviously is completely different to the one we're doing with Magnus, also due to individual things, so on. So to give a short answer to your question, testing is good if you understand it. If you don't understand it, don't use it. And I think that comes down to everything in life. But I also think, testing is, it's way more than just giving like a VO2 max and so on. I think testing also with the Nice course for the Ironman World Championship and also Kona. Now, I don't want to go too much into details, sorry, but you can also test certain things for those races, which eventually will make you perform a better result on race day. So you can use testing in many different ways, but the most important thing is that you understand the testing you're doing. And that's also why I would say that people out there, if they are trying to do some kind of test themselves, they have to make sure that they understand it themselves, or at least is having people around who can help them understand the data and analyze it and eventually use it in a positive way. Otherwise, it's a waste of energy, it's a waste of money, and it eventually will just have a negative influence on them.
Yeah, very interesting. Couldn't agree more. When athletes, so this is an in my opinion where I'm basically, instead of people firing questions at me and me answering them, I'm firing questions at you that I've been interested in asking you, but then also other people have asked you and I, right? So one other thing I'd like to ask you about is shoes and gear. So as a run coach, I'm sometimes, not always, asked, okay, I'm doing this key workout 3 weeks before a marathon. It's 3x5K in a 30K run at marathon effort. Should I use super shoes or shouldn't I? Now, there is definitely no correct answer to this topic. There's absolutely no correct answer. And I think having asked a lot of professional runners about this, there is no correct answer. There's lots of different ways to do it. There's lots of opinions. But I guess I'm asking you from the standpoint of me being interested in doing triathlon, because at some point I would like to try and run or do a sub-10 Ironman. So I might actually call upon your direct services at some point.
Yes.
That's not coming in the next few years. But
and we have to record this. We have to make a YouTube about this. But you have to promise everyone now.
Well, I'm doing one for sure. And when I posted on my Instagram, I posted on Strava the other day, someone said I'd be closer to sub-9, which I thought, I don't know, it's hard to tell, but this isn't about me, it's about you. What gear do you think is out there for people to be able to use that is genuinely helpful in training? Like, do you think super shoes are helpful? Do you think they can be helpful? And in the swimming and biking legs as well, like, what do you think is out there? And you don't have to name brands, you can just name specific equipment. But I'm just curious to know from the standpoint of potentially doing a long course triathlon at some point, what gear I would need to enhance my training, like would actually help me with my training.
Especially in a sport like triathlon, this is a really difficult question because there is so much merch out there that, I mean, it's nice to have, but in the end, is it like a need to have? And I think especially in these days where everything with testing, super shoes, as you're mentioning, aerodynamics on the bike, everything, like you can spend a lot of money on it, but in the end, you can also keep it quite simple. And I think in the end, it comes down to also expectations and level, because triathlon can also be a really simple sport where you don't need to have the newest super shoes and don't need to have the newest bike. The good thing about swimming is that obviously you can buy a really expensive wetsuit, but I think actually the more, if you are a newbie triathlete who hasn't really been swimming that much, going out and buying the most expensive wetsuit out there actually wouldn't be the best option for you, because most of the times the best wetsuits out there is produced for pro athletes who has a really high swim level. And obviously in swimming, there is different demands for wetsuit in terms of if you're an experienced swimmer and if you're a non-experienced swimmer. For instance, pro athletes used, like, don't really have that much buoyance or around like the legs and so on. So you float more, because eventually pro athletes can float really well in the water, obviously. But if you are a newbie swimmer, triathlete, you don't have like as good experience by floating in the water. So obviously you need a little bit of more buoyance in the wetsuit. And eventually then it will be better for you to actually buy a less expensive wetsuit with more buoyance around like your hip area and legs. So it's really difficult to come up with a concrete answer that like circles everyone. So sorry about that, but I think there may be an interesting thing to talk about. And I think also you can join in here, Matt, is also about the super shoes, because that's also where I think it's interesting that you see a lot of people maybe running a marathon in 4 hours and 30 minutes, let's say that, which eventually still is a good time. But I think for them, maybe going out and use a bunch of money on the new super shoes, I don't think that eventually that will make a difference, because I think we have to have in mind that if we take the new Alpha Flight 3, they are made for a guy or guys, female athletes that are running between 2 hours and 2 hours and 20 on the marathon. And obviously the demands of the shoes from running 20K an hour compared to 10K an hour, like, it's completely different. And I guess this is also your experience, Matt, is that when you're running in a super shoe, sometimes when I'm running myself, I don't always bother to go out in my easy runners for the warm-up and then carry on my super shoes for the track. So sometimes I just start the warm-up in my super shoes as well. And I find it, like, normally I just do my warm-up in like 5 minutes per K. That's 12K an hour. And I think when I'm trying to do that in my super shoes, it feels so awkward. Like, it's really not stable. It's the bounce is really odd. And unless that I'm actually running a little bit fast in my warm-up, they feel better and better the faster I run. So I think for an athlete who is running 12K an hour or slower in a marathon, for instance, I wouldn't say actually that a super shoe is beneficial for them. And I would like to hear your opinion about it, Matt, because you obviously have way more experience than me in marathon. But yeah, that's just my opinion on it. So interesting to hear.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it definitely does change the trajectory of the stride when you're going, you use the example of 20K an hour to 10K an hour. And the way the foot plants and so on and so forth. I mean, I'm not a expert here, but I know for sure you are correct. It's a different ball game. Is it worth the money for someone, you know, running 4 hours? It's hard to say. There is definitely an element that I often forget about, and it's one that I think at the very elite end. And I'm not saying by any means I'm at the very elite end of marathon running, but I think when you're sort of recreational, there's an element of wanting to be in a club and wanting to be a part of the, you know, I think there was actually a post by one of the media companies the other day about how marathon running has become a new fashion festival. It's like you're seeing all these cool brands and all these cool shoes and everything. And I think an element of it is not performance. It's about fitting in, and it's about and being the part. And I think that's something that you and I don't fully probably understand, because we just want to see people perform their best, and we probably then make opinions about how could that person allocate their financial situation in the best way to make them run faster, right? Whereas for many people, they might be thinking, yeah, but I also want to look the part and have the best shoes because everyone else has the best shoes. So, but speaking specifically to the point of like, how much do they help you? It's so hard to know. And there's so many different opinions about this, and it depends a lot on the person, their foot strike, and so on and so forth. But yeah, having recently learned that Cooper Tier and Cole Hocker, two of the best milers and 5K guys in the US, they very rarely use super shoes. They basically do most of their workouts in pretty heavy Nike structures, which are just, you know, a pretty heavy trainer. They even do their tempo runs in them. It's interesting to learn that, because you would think that using them in training would improve your performance in sort of indirect ways, right? If you're running faster in training, it will give you belief to think that you're actually running faster in workouts. But I think when you have a lot of deep confidence in your own abilities, and you know that, okay, well, super shoes will be a few seconds per K, probably faster in training, but I don't have to worry about that. I'm happy with my kilometer reps or my 800 reps in this pace, as opposed to that pace, super shoe pace. as long as you can think through these things, I think you can definitely get away with doing a lot of training without super shoes and not being hindered and not affecting your performance. But there's also another train of thought that one of my good friends actually believes in, and he says, don't use super shoes until the race, because then when you throw them on, you feel so good that you get this big boost on race day. And I can sort of see that too. And I did preface this whole part to say that there's no correct answer here, right? It's just opinions. It's just different thoughts and ideas. But no, it's an interesting one that I don't think anyone really has a firm answer. And when I hear coaches give firm answers, I just think like it's not necessarily correct what you're saying. Like there is no real answer here. It's about finding what works best for you, and that's through trial and error, and then being confident in what you're doing. I think that's a pretty big deal. And I think that then leads us to sort of one of the more important things I wanted to ask you about, and it's an interesting topic of conversation. It's like instilling confidence and assurance in the athlete's ability to perform. And I think that's something that we've had really good feedback, you know, about your coaching and your ability to basically instill confidence in people when they go into a race. Because who was it the other day that I heard? Oh, it was actually Rudy Von Berg's videos I was watching before interviewing him. And his videographer said, it's a really big deal to have big belief in what you want to do. And Rudy was like, yeah, of course it is. And it's something that I think a lot of people don't fully understand. It's like having really firm belief in your ability and having confidence when you get to the start line. And I think that is a really big benefit of having a good coach. But if you could speak a little bit to that in terms of how you might help athletes, you know, get that confidence and get that, instill that ability to perform well on race day, that would be really interesting to hear about.
Yeah, I think maybe the best example I can come up with is that, obviously, I mean, working with Magnus, and this has also always been really interesting thing, is that even from Magnus's first race, which was back in 2019, just before COVID, two completely different things. It was a challenge race in Davos, Switzerland. And even though this was his first pro race, he actually went into the race with the mindset that this is just a race. I want to win. I want to be the best athlete out there. And obviously, he knows that it's not just as easy as it is like going out and win your first pro race. And eventually he ended up finished fourth, doing really well. But in all races like Magnus has attached or prepared for and so on, it's been with the mindset that, okay, what can I do in training, in my preparation, to make sure that I have the best cars on race day to be able to win? And I don't see that actually with a lot of athletes. But as you mentioned, also with the confidence, and the confidence here is also an really interesting thing, because I have recently, beginning of this year, started working with a British pro triathlete, George Goodwin, who for people might remember him, and at least Rudy knows him, because in 2021, he made sure that Rudy didn't got his third back-to-back win in Elsinore at the European Championship. So George Goodwin, he won the European Championship on the half distance back in 2021. But unfortunately, he'd had like a couple of unlucky years where he's really struggled to, I think he was fighting some overtraining and also like a confidence with him himself. And now like I started working with him a few months ago, and actually tomorrow, at least when we are recording this podcast, I think after when we're publishing it, he has been racing. But tomorrow, George is racing the 70.3 Ironman in Valencia, which will be like his first race back in quite a while. And obviously here with George, like, I think obviously he has the same mindset as Magnus. Obviously also when you have been a European champion and he finished third at the PTO championship behind Gustav Iden back in 2020. So obviously he is naturally a winner, but for him, for tomorrow and during this season, we have actually made an agreement, and we was also on the phone prior to this podcast where we're going through the race tomorrow, and he actually has had a little bit of a sore throat. But I was telling him that, like, honestly, I don't care that you have a sore throat now, because remember that tomorrow's race and this season is just about you getting back to racing. Like, you need to get out there, get your confidence back, get the trust back in yourself that, okay, the things that we are applying in training eventually will pay deficit on race day and all these kind of things. So, I mean, tomorrow, if he's finishing fifth, if he wins the race or finishing in third position or so on, like, we really don't care, because this whole year is just about getting back into racing, get back the experience and boost his confidence. So in the longer perspective, that he will be able to get back to winning days. I'm not saying that we don't want George to win tomorrow, because as I'm also talking with him, obviously we have still made a race tactic for him, which eventually is with the mindset that we want him to deliver the best possible result. But we are not in a place now where we want to go out and say, okay, we want to win this, and this race. Like, we are looking more long term. So it's not because I want to go out on a sidetrack or something. I mean, maybe I have gone a little bit around the question. Sorry about that. But I think it's just to showcase how you need to sometimes approach race differently, even though that you have an athlete or two different athletes who want to win, both of them. So yeah, I just think it was a really interesting thing to maybe go up with that. Like, sometimes it's not always about winning. It's also about using races with different purpose.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. I mean, I think sometimes running a half marathon or a marathon for training purposes, even when you're not fully fit, can be a really good idea. And it can also bring back really positive, jumping into it, especially you can speak more to triathlon. I've never done one, but if you do a half marathon race for training, it can bring back a lot of really good positive vibes and feelings about racing again. Because it's no secret that, if you go to watch a major marathon in person, you leave pretty inspired and pumped up to run a marathon. So jumping into a race that maybe isn't your big target, or you're going into it even if you're not 100% fit, but you're using it for training, I think it can be very valuable. So no, thanks for sharing that. All right, we'll wrap up this In My Opinion with a couple of opinions about the rest of the year. What do you think Christian and Gustav are thinking leading into the Olympics in Kona? Do you know anything about Gustav and him competing at the Olympics? Do we have any idea? Do you know anything about that?
I don't know anything in particular.
Looks like you're keeping something to yourself.
Maybe I do, but I don't think that. I can actually back this up, because I think Olaf actually said it in the interview. So it's coming more from Olaf rather than me, which I think is good, that Gustav will more focusing on the full distance this year. And I think actually Gustav showed in an Instagram post recently that he was really close to start his season. And I think that will not be draft legal race. That will be a non-draft race, which I think is a sign that Gustav is all in on Kona this year. Obviously, he doesn't need to qualify, because he won Kona, the Ironman World Championship from Hawaii, which means that he has to validate. He can validate his slot through doing an Ironman, where he just needs to finish, or he can participate in two half-distance Ironman races and in that way validate his slot. So I think, and this is just my opinion, I think he'll start his season at the 70.3 Mallorca in just over 4 weeks. It's just a guess. And with Christian, I think he is focusing on both things, but I think he's focusing now 110% on the Olympics. Then when the Olympics is done, he is focusing on Hawaii.
I don't understand how someone does that. I mean, I think there's like 9 weeks or 10 weeks or maybe 8 weeks in between the two. And to have to go through the emotional, I mean, especially if he wins, right, or he comes top three, the emotional outlet, and then have to get back into Ironman training for 2 months, that would be so
hard. And we should have in mind that he needs to validate as well. So either he has to go out and do Ironman Frankfurt, which is the last race he can do, which is in the end of August, or he has to do 270.3s. So, I mean, potentially he could be in a situation where he is doing the Olympics by the end of July, beginning of August. I can't remember where
it's in August.
In August, the beginning of August. Then in the end of August, he is doing Ironman Frankfurt. Then he needs to recover really quickly, do his heat and Ironman specific training leading into Kona in October. So one hell of a schedule, huh?
That is wild. Well, it's actually, yeah, it's the first week of August. I actually thought it was in the second half of August for some reason. Yeah. So the triathlon competitions at the Paris Olympics are between the 30th of July and the 5th of August. So yeah, you could be predicting his exact racing schedule there. We will see. But that guy, I mean, yeah, nothing surprises us after his Singapore win last year, where he flew overnight and arrived the day before and still won.
Christian, he is one and a kind in many ways. And just as a funny side story here, I remember when, I think that was when we were at the Collins Cup in Saint Marin, must be 2 years ago soon, where like Gustav, he came into our room. I was living with Magnus because I think he needed like a bike tool or something. And he came with Christian. Like, but Christian was just standing outside of our like hotel room with the door was open. And I remember just at one point looking out and Christian was just like standing there and like dancing. Like he wasn't really even listening to some kind of music, but he was just standing there in his own thoughts, like dancing a little bit. I was like, why don't you come in? Like, no, but he was just standing out there and dancing. I mean, it was 10 p.m. in the evening or so, but yeah, that's just Christian.
Those guys, yeah, that doesn't surprise me at all. I mean, I can't say I know either of them super well, but when I did go to Morocco and join them for dinner one night, they invited me around to their place. And when I arrived, they were both dressed in Moroccan robes, which really took me by surprise. I was like, hey, well, did I miss the memo about what I was supposed to do tonight? Or they're really funny. Well, Casper, thanks for joining the podcast. Any more ideas or any more stories for now? Or can we can obviously get you, we'll have you back on repeatedly throughout the year, but any more thoughts on the upcoming couple of races? And I guess actually one more thing I did want to ask you about, sorry, before we do round off, is at the moment, as of today, how does the outlook for Magnus look for the next few months?
The rehab process from our doctors here in Denmark is still quite positive. He's back running. He's back biking for now, only indoors though, as he's still struggling to really put pressure on his wrist, but it's fine once you're on the home trainer. He can run. He's still like only doing easy runs at this point because like he had like a pretty hard fall on his right side glute, which eventually had a little bit more damage than we first thought. But with swimming, that will potentially take a few weeks still. I think normally the rehab process is 5 to 6 weeks. The problem with the fracture he got now in the bone is that the blood flow to that area of the bone is really limited. So like I think it only has blood supply from one area, which obviously makes the recovery process quite slow. But we hope that he will be back in the pool in maybe 2 weeks' time, at least slowly starting to get back. But actually, when he broke his collarbone in his like big crash he had almost 4 or 5 years ago now, he swam a one-arm crawl and only kick for, I think it was 3 months in a row. So even though he actually had a broken collarbone, he still went to the pool 4 times a week. Swam the series with only one arm instead of two, which eventually also like mentally, I don't really think people out there can imagine how much mental energy that takes as well, going into the pool 6 o'clock in the morning with the rest of the squad who are just hamming away, where you are limited to only swim with one arm.
And must be going to show how motivated he is though, right? He's so dedicated.
Exactly. And I haven't spoke with him about actually that could be potentially an idea just to still have that feel for the water. But all, actually, like it was a plan of ours to have a season break post Singapore, because I think that's also a thing that now normally triathletes maybe could be in top shape 1 or 2 times a year. But now with the new T100 series, Roth as well, Hawaii, of course, like you have to be in at least like a really, really good shape almost the whole year round. And that's also why we thought that, okay, it's actually good to still divide the season into like the different parts and actually take a bit of a season break also mentally in order not to be burned out when we are on Hawaii and also for the T100 grand final later on in the season. So yeah, the main plan now is that he will potentially be racing the next T100 series in San Francisco, which originally not it wasn't actually the plan, but after the Singapore disaster, we hopefully will be doing that one. After that, one of the big goals of the season is Rough. He's trying to go for his three peak win there. Obviously, last year was a big one for him. He broke the world record, won the race for the second time, and he is currently unbeaten on the Rough course. So let's see if we, I mean, we obviously had the talk that it could be fun to win three times in a row and break his own world record. But last year, he on the bike had like same lay low. They were biking the whole bike course together. And obviously Sam is a really, really strong rider and a triathlete. But I think having him out there on the bike really helped to that they could keep the pace high and take certain leads, even though that they're obviously still, it is an undraft race. But this year, Sam won't be racing. So that could potentially make an impact on the bike time. So, I mean, that's the goal. And then I think we're also looking into a really, really exciting second half of the season.
Well, looking forward to checking back in with you on the podcast repeatedly throughout the year. But I guess lastly, as we wrap up, you do have availability at the moment for coaching. Am I right?
You are totally right. I think now we are currently looking at having eight or nine athletes in the Triathlon Academy. I think we are just growing the community. And I know I've said it before, but I mean, what you have established on Discord is simply just amazing. And what I think is even more amazing now is that the triathletes that we are also now, when we're having more and more triathletes to the team, is that they are also connecting more and more with the runners. They are talking different threads. And also, I think that's also why it's so nice to do a podcast with you, Matt, is that we both come from endurance sport, but obviously you have the run background. I have the triathlon background. And like the fact that we come in with different perspectives just makes it so interesting. And I think that's just so nice. I also sometimes I just grab my phone and look into Discord for an hour or two, just looking through the different threads we have there, discussions about training. And even me as a coach, I get new perspective from our athletes, which I think is really nice and meaningful as well.
Awesome. So you can learn more about coaching with Sweat Elite Coaching Academy at sweatelite.com. You can find the link in the podcast episode here. Thanks, Casper, for joining. We'll check in with you again soon. Appreciate it. And thanks everyone for listening in.